You're listening to the Fusion Patrol Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Ben.
And tonight we're going to be looking at the series finale of Doctor Who, The Wedding of River Song. So it's been a long road working our way up through the whole River Song story and going her way and going his way and back and forth through time, and all the pieces have been placed before us, and this episode is the payoff, if you will, of the story. And in that respect, this is the grand finale. So, what'd you think?
Not what I had hoped it to be.
You had hopes?
I had hopes.
I mean, I kind of thought we had both resigned ourselves that it was just going to be no possible way it could be good.
That is true. I pretty much had resigned myself to the fact that it was going to be just a complete waste of time. But I kept – there was a little tiny part inside that just said, maybe I've missed something. Maybe Moff will really pull an amazing rabbit out of his hat that is just so spectacular that I can walk away from this and saying, wow, I never saw that coming and I liked it.
Tell you what, I'm going to say I did not hate this like Let's I Kill Hitler.
I did not hate this episode. Not by any means.
I think that all the damage had been done. You know, I mean, all of the stuff that was just beginning to tick me off about the ridiculous nature of this timeline story, which just can't work. And, I mean, it really had kind of culminated in Let's Kill Hitler as to how awful this plot was working out to be. And so, in its conclusion, there were certainly many, many, I have scads of questions that have come about. And these are not the kind of questions that you're like looking forward to an answer in the future. These are questions like, you know, you're never
going.
Yeah, they're just plot holes and things that just don't make any sense or weren't thought out or not, but questions nonetheless. But that notwithstanding, it was kind of, for the first time, it was kind of a fun ride.
It was a little bit. I'll give Moffat that. I mean, he seems to be good at least crafting a fun ride type episode. I mean, he did that with Big Bang. While there were some plot holes that I'm still, you know, desperately trying to find some resolutions for. For the most part, I thought Big Bang was a fun ride, and this one was no different. Perfect episode? No, it has its problems, mostly in the storytelling. To me, a lot of it was just wasteful time. It felt like just a little.
Well, it did seem like time wasn't moving much.
Well, yeah. Ha ha, ba-dum-bum. But there was just too much, almost too much exposition.
You know, it's funny. I feel like they got rid of a lot of the exposition from the earlier ones where they were explaining this and explaining that and explaining that. And so now we're just down to, you know,
well, this is what
the moment.
Except for everything that the soothsayer is now relaying back to Emperor Churchill.
Yeah. I'll start my nitpicky little gripey thing with that. Not plot-wise, but stylistically-wise. I'm tired of the jump to the future and then replaying it back to catch you up to where,
in case you missed
you
anything,
you didn't need to be. It's like, yeah, all they had to do was to tell it in order. All they had to do is tell it in order. Instead, when they come to these things, they leap far forward. Just like they did in Day of the Astronaut and Impossible Moon, or vice versa. They they ended one on a cliffhanger, and then they leapt far into the future.
Way too far.
And then we didn't get a whole lot of what happened in between either, which was particularly annoying. But this is, and Big Bang, we got some of that.
Yeah, we got some of that. It wasn't as egregious in Big Bang. Not like it was in Day of the Moon.
Day of the Moon was the worst of the
bunch. That was horrible. This, yeah, there was a lot of this too. I mean, I kept coming up with, okay, you know, and even after the doctor finished explaining more or less why things are the way they are, I still had to keep asking myself the question, and how did you end up in this situation?
Well, there's two further points in the story, which we can get to at the point where they do exactly the same thing. We're shown a scene, we pass through the scene, and then much later in the episode, we are shown going back to that same scene and then replaying it differently. Or replaying just a little bit further into it, and suddenly the scene is completely different. And makes a whole difference in the story. And, you know, I mean, yes, that's a way of concealing it from the viewer. But it's kind of gimmicky, and I'm tired of it. You know, it's just been played.
I don't care for it because there's no way that the viewer, as they see the scenes played out in their original airing or original order, the poor viewer has no way of being able to guess.
Yes,
what really
you're not
happened?
Given any...
No, because you are being there's
astray.
A vital cue, a vital clue that is being withheld, and that's a cheat in of itself as far as storytelling goes, and I don't care for that.
All right, well, let's take a look at this show in the little breaky bits. We start out and we are shown that it's April, I think, 22nd, 5:02 p.m., London, of some indeterminately strange nature. It's got the steam trains going into the Gherkin. We've got automobiles suspended by hot air balloons. We have Roman soldiers, the pterodactyls in Hyde Park. Charles Dickens is on the BBC Breakfast Show, plugging his upcoming Christmas Carol, Christmas special. Winston Churchill is the Holy Roman Emperor at the Buckingham Senate building.
With a Silurian physician.
With a Silurian physician. He's talking about his discussions with Cleopatra. And he's noticing that the clock never moves. And he asks his physician what time it is, and the Silurian physician says, well, it's 5:02. And he looks at a clock, and the clock is ticking, but it's 5:02. And he looks at his calendar, and it says it's April 22nd, and he says something, and it's always April 22nd. Now, for starters, a clock is not actually measuring, it's not tied to time in any way, shape, or form. It's just a mechanical device. So, you know, the clock should still be running. So, and they personally have time because they seem to be able to move about in time. They're going forward. They're talking one direction. They are beings
they
that
are existing
in time. Yes. And so, I don't like the clock thing. That's just kind of silly.
Well, if the clock were to not work, then they should not work.
Exactly. Time would actually be stuck.
Exactly. And that's the other thing that really bothered me, in addition to them not being frozen in time, is that, okay, all of history has merged together and no one is the wiser except for apparently Winston Churchill.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
Yeah,
he's aware that something is not right. Now, if no one else is the wiser, what I want to know is, would anyone be aware of the concept of the clock or the calendar?
Well, I mean,
would they even know that? Because this all of history has now been mashed together in this brand new alternate timeline, and I mean, to the Silurian, he says, well, it's always been this way. Well, if it has always been this way, then you should have no concept of what a clock is, because really you'd have no need for one.
Yeah, there's all sorts of problems with the idea behind this. I mean, let's just say that all of time has been thrown together, and that explains why you can have Winston Churchill and Cleopatra. It does not explain why it's not Prime Minister Winston Churchill as opposed to Holy Roman Emperor Winston Churchill.
Yeah.
And it doesn't explain how Charles Dickens, if everything has been thrown all together, how can Charles Dickens have a play coming out
on Christmas?
Christmas Carol play. When would also be one of the things that was thrown in, so therefore Christmas Carol would already exist. It just doesn't. It doesn't hold up anymore. Why would cars be hanging off balloons? Or it just, you know, it's cool. Somebody probably sat down and said that would be kind of a neat looking.
It looks especially steampunky,
but it doesn't really wash.
It doesn't stand. No, it doesn't stand. It doesn't bear any scrutiny.
It doesn't spare any scrutiny at all. And now the question with regards to Winston Churchill recognizing something. Now I would be willing to go that there might be an excuse, but then they blow it. And here's one of my questions. One of my many questions about this program had to do with. Okay, Winston Churchill is sort of aware that the Doctor was his friend. By the way, the Doctor has been thrown. He's the soothsayer and has been thrown in the Tower of London. And
because he keeps saying, time is broken.
Time is broken. And he's called down again because Churchill wants to know why time is always
502. Why is time broken?
And this time the Doctor gets to explain his story about how he hunted for the silence. He decided to go... You know, instead of going quietly, he decided he was going to go out fighting and goes through a series of events to get to that point. And how ultimately River Song was in the spacesuit and she couldn't kill him. And so she discharged her weapon, into the ground. I don't know. And
discharge it somewhere. It doesn't matter. But yeah, she didn't fire it at him.
And so then the fixed point in time dissolved and...
It's split.
Everything is all screwed up, and we're in this parallel universe. And the Doctor says, you were my friend to Winston Churchill, and that's why you kind of perceive that time is wrong. He takes Churchill along, and as he's talking to Churchill, they change locations mysteriously, and the Doctor starts getting tick marks on his arm. And there's progressively... showing more and more things like now one of them's got a gun, then the gun's been shot, now the Doctor's carrying a sword. So they're obviously kind of fighting the silence, the alien silence, as distinguished from supposedly the religious order, the silence, if they can be differentiated. But what's that all about? I mean, why are the silence running around? Why are the silence... doing things? Why don't they just kill the Doctor? Do they even remember? I mean, they've been flumped into this alternate timeline, too. Do they have any recollection of what's going on?
Good question.
So, or Madame Kavorian? Why should she?
Yeah, that's also a very, very good question. We do know from later on in the episode... we do have a bit of a reunion with a past character. I won't say who yet. I suppose I could.
You mean Miss Pond?
Amelia Pond. I was referring to Dorian Maldivar.
Oh yeah.
And he describes the silence as
sentinels of history.
The sentinels of history. Now one of my big questions is, when did they appoint themselves to that job? Was it after the Time War? After the Time Lords kind of – or after the Doctor kind of wiped the Time Lords and the Daleks out of existence? Did the silence all of a sudden decide to step up to the plate and take on that mantle?
Yeah, it's unclear. Well, but okay. So let's slip back to that for a second. Then we'll talk about that because that is in the part where the Doctor.
The reason I asked that is I'm wondering, does this also allow for them to maybe be able to observe what's going on and also have some sense of what's happening, much like the Doctor can?
Perhaps. perhaps. I guess let's step back for a second and talk about Dorian. The Doctor, when he's on his hunt, he's describing this to Churchill. He hunts down a Dalek and destroys it and takes its memory core about the Silence. He then tracks down a servant of the Silence.
Ex-servant of the Silence.
Who he knows to be dead, and so therefore he reveals that to be the Tesselecta guys, the same crew from Let's Kill Hitler. And he talks to them, trying to find out who the Silence weakest link is. It turns out to be Mark Gatiss. And they're having...
Who I didn't even recognize.
Who they were having a game of...
Live chess.
Live chess, which is stolen right out of an episode of Blake 7, where, you know, the loser is electrocuted and dies. The Doctor blackmails him into telling him what's all this all about. And he says the only guy who knows is Dorian. And he says, well, he's dead. And he says, well, yeah, you know, let me out of this and I'll take you to him. So he does. Well, Dorian, beheaded by the headless monks, it turns out all those heads continue to live.
Because they were beheaded alive.
Yeah, that's...
Suspend disbelief just long enough. If the bodies are able to function without the heads,
right?
Okay, I'll go along with it and say the heads can function without the bodies. Fine, I'll move on.
Up until the point where the brains rot away and stuff, then I'm a little...
Well, of course, then I have a problem with, like, oh, how's he laughing? He has no lungs. He has no vocal cords.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it doesn't work, but it's fun. And we get to see Dorian back again, so he explains to the Doctor, and he tells us a bunch of stuff. And some important things is that the Silence consider themselves the Sentinels of History. And they are trying to prevent the question, the oldest question, the question in plain sight from the dawn of time. They're trying to prevent that question from being answered, because when that question answers, the Silence will fall.
Actually, and then he says... a better translation is, the Silence must fall.
The Silence must fall. And, but the Silence turns out to be the death of the Doctor. The Doctor says so himself. So therefore, then why are they trying to prevent the question? If that's being answered, if that will bring about the end of the Doctor, they're trying to stop the Silence from falling, and yet they keep seeming to be trying to engineer it.
It was a double meaning.
Double meaning. So anyway, we've got he says that what they're trying to prevent is the fields of Trenzalore at the fall of the 11th. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink.
Yeah.
You might think that might be the 11th Legion, but I think they're talking the 11th Doctor.
The Doctor.
When no living creature can speak falsely or fail to answer a question.
A question will be asked.
A question, and then a question will be asked.
A question that must never, ever be answered.
And
boy, I hate to say this, but I knew what that question was even long before we found out.
We'll talk about that.
It was so obvious. Anyway.
It's so obvious. It says, but I don't believe it's a question since the beginning of time. But that's another. We'll get to that at the end. Anyway, yeah. But it's vitally important that the Doctor not reach Trenzalore, because obviously he can answer the question. And... they don't know. So my first question is, how do the Silence know the future?
If they're the sentinels of all history,
how do they know the
past,
future?
Past, present, and future.
Then they know the answer. Then they've already been past it.
They know the answer. They just don't. I know. There's a huge, massive contradiction that goes on here.
Yes.
Because one of the other things that's going on here is the Doctor asks Dorian, why Lake Silencio, Utah? And Dorian tells him that it is a still point in time. I don't know. I've never heard of a location being a still point in time, but let's go with that. And that because it is a still point in time, it makes it easier to create a fixed point in time. And the Doctor's death is a fixed point in time, according to Dorian. Well, no, it isn't. It's not a fixed point in time if the Silence are trying to engineer the Doctor's death, which is what apparently they're doing.
Right. It's almost like they're trying to engineer a fixed point in time. Now,
yes.
Now, maybe that's valid, because if they're worried about in the future the Doctor being somewhere where he can't be, that will cause problems for some reason by answering this question, then if they create a fixed point in time, that maybe that's the only way That's the only way to kill a being that's like this, that's
well,
temporally
the doctor,
non-linear.
The doctor kind of he describes it in that sort of way by telling Churchill, if you knew someone who had a secret that must never, ever be told, the best way to destroy that secret is I would have to kill the person.
Right.
So that's exactly what's happening here.
So, but here's the problem with that. We'll jump ahead. So the doctor is a nonlinear being. I mean, he lives life in a nonlinear fashion. Unless the silence knows every last second of every day, of every hour, and every place the doctor has ever, ever been in all his lives, killing him will not necessarily prevent him from being there. He may have already done this, and they just don't know it because that was in his past. So, unfortunately, that's this problem with having characters operating on different... Well, the Doctor being able to plop in and out. You know, we have 200 years from when he dropped off Amy and Rory to when he stopped by to visit Craig. We don't know what he did. I think we can safely say he spent a lot of time with River. I think that's where all their Easter Island and all that stuff came from, was in that segment of time.
Very possible.
Because, well, remember when they compared books?
Yeah, at the very beginning of Impossible
Astronaut. They had a whole bunch of different events, so a lot of that occurred, if not everything. And I'll get to that. I think it's everything. But... he may have gone there already. He may have been to Trenzanor and already done this. We don't know. Although, you'd think he'd know that when he was talking to Dorian, but it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Anyhow, so Amelia Pond shows up. The Doctor and Kurt Churchill are about to get killed by the Silence in this alternate reality, and Amy shows up with machine guns and some military guys and chops them all down.
And an eye patch.
Or an eye drive, as we turn out that they've been found. She takes the doctor on what I'm subsequently told was supposed to be the Orient Express.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They don't mention it in the show, but I did watch the Doctor Who Confidential on this one because, well, it's the last Doctor Who Confidential. And this is the key reason I watched. Well, I watched it for two reasons. One, they had the kids' production of Doctor Who that they shot. Was aired on that Confidential.
Ah.
And it's the final episode of Doctor Who Confidential. And so that makes three reasons, doesn't it? And they have a, from River's point of view, recap of her timeline.
So that might be worth, make it worth watching.
It's worth watching just to see her timeline go through from
her point of view as opposed to the Doctor's.
Correct.
Because that's how we've been seeing it.
And it raises some fascinating issues, but I'll get to that too. That when you watch it in her order, suddenly you go, oh, wait a second, here is another problem.
Interesting. I wish I'd had the opportunity to see that.
Amy is sort of a James Bondian type.
I don't know. I was thinking more like James West.
Well, because of the train?
She's got an
office. I mean, she comes in and she says, you know, Pond, Amelia Pond. I mean, if you're not doing a Bond joke, I don't know what you are there. The doctor starts trying to convince her that, you know me, we were best friends. And she's got like a TARDIS sitting there in her office, and she's got all these sketches of Daleks and pirates and
vampires
and stuff up on her wall. And the doctor realizes that she remembers. She grew up next to the rift in the wall. She remembers. And that makes sense. Churchill's just sort of an acquaintance, and he has a better thing. Amy's an extremely close acquaintance, and she's even more steeped in it.
As the doctor had said, I think it was in The Big Bang, I mean, she had the entire universe basically just pouring through her bedroom. And going right through her. So yeah, I can accept the fact that she would have a better recollection that things are amiss.
We get to the pyramids, and River is
there. Area
52. And she remembers, but that makes sense. She's got a time head. Madame Kavorian is a prisoner, and she remembers. I don't know why.
Yeah, that's a great one. I have no idea why she should
remember. They've got hundreds of Silence trapped in Area 52. When did they have time to do that? I mean, I don't know. But then my whole theory that, you know, proximity to the doctor or something has something to do, because Rory has absolutely not the slightest recollection at all. So, you know, it would have made more sense. This would have been the situation where, you know, the people who remembered it should have been like a rogues gallery of the doctor's companions.
Well, yes, and I would expect Rory to, because with he had done enough traveling in
enough
the TARDIS.
Died enough times in the TARDIS. That,
true, I mean, but just traveling enough times in the TARDIS, it has been suggested that it alters one's perceptions.
Yes, yes, you've traveled in the TARDIS, you'll never be the same. You're slightly immune to time. Yeah, all that stuff. It didn't seem to affect him.
No effect on him at all.
At all. So once the doctor arrives, the Silence turn out that they're really playing possum and they try to kill everybody. The doctor, however, is trying still to die. He has determined that he has to be at Lake Silencio, otherwise the universe will end, and the only way to do it is for him to touch River, and by touching River, the two poles of the schism will come together, and time will restore itself, and they go through this whole, you know, I don't want to marry you, River, and River's like, I don't want to kill you, and... Yeah, okay, there wasn't much there to it, just a little flirting, bandy stuff. Then the
say something that was really bothering me a lot about this scene. We've had Madame Kevorian being this very strange, enigmatic character who really kind of, in A Good Man Goes to War, really comes to the forefront. And here she's just
nothing.
She's a nothing character. She borders on irrelevancy. In fact, she's rendered irrelevant by the aliens, the Silence aliens themselves. Yep. And I thought, well, why was she here all along then? I mean, you just don't prop up a villain. You know, I mean, it's not uncommon to take this a collective identity or group and then make a figurehead. To be your villain, it makes it kind of easier to write stories with. But then she's almost summarily dismissed in this, and it felt rather hollow.
Just an opportunity for Amy to kill her.
But it still felt very hollow.
River and Amy and the folks there at this little lab, who, by the way, all say, you know, some of us know that there's something wrong with time. So apparently it's sort of a general feeling that some people get. And the Silence start advancing on the Doctor now that he's there. They want to kill him. Even though, again, if they've created a fixed point in time, why should they even bother trying? He has to be there for it. I'm not, you know, again, I'm not quite getting that.
Not trying to get their motive.
Yeah, they're really just very, very... I don't understand what the Silence are up to, frankly. And River and Amy take the Doctor up to the pyramid where they reveal that they've made this distress beacon because the rest of the universe is still working temporarily anyway. And they've called out for help for the Doctor. And millions of voices come back. Yes, of course we'll help. We love the Doctor.
I have a problem with this.
Mm-hmm.
Here we have, in A Good Man Goes to War, there's this big preaching going on about what a terrible person the Doctor is becoming.
But that's...
I know that River was saying that if you keep going down this path, this is what you're going to be. But at the same time, she was... That River at that moment seemed to be speaking from, no, this is who you are. Look around. You know, the Doctor says, I didn't want this. She says, oh, did you? Look at what you're doing. I mean, the army that runs away just at the mentioning of his words. So we've had this sense of...
And that's the River from after this point in time.
Uh-huh. So we get this sense that there's this very evil thing the Doctor is. But now we come to this, and the Doctor is – he's a loved savior to the universe.
Yes, but, you know, millions upon millions out of 200 billion stars in our galaxy and 200 billion galaxies in our universe. There could be just as many out there that are shouting, no, destroy the Doctor. I mean, I think that's the point behind the religious order that I think we're calling the silence now. In other words, the military that we're in, a good man goes to war, the headless monks, the people
they're
that Kavor in with,
the same thing.
Are they all, is that the silence?
I get the feeling they all are. Because Dorian does say that this, actually, I take it back, it's a Tesselecta. When they access the memory banks.
It's a religious order, right?
It's a religious order or movement.
So I don't know whether that's an affiliated movement or whether that was the silence as well. So we'll just call them the silence for the sake of this argument. They are the silence, and then the guys in the suits and the funny heads, they are the alien silence, who are the head of the silence. It seems to be,
for lack of a better
hierarchy of this clearly undefined system. And yet, the military that we see in Time of Angels clearly is a religious order of the opposite side. They are the Doctor's side. So I don't think it's unrealistic to say that some people would interpret the Doctor as good, and some people would interpret the Doctor as bad. He is two sides of a legend.
Yeah,
and
but the thing that only bothers me, though, is River's take on that. She describes him from her own point of view. She describes him as, you are becoming this horribly bad person. How dare you? And yet now, no, Doctor, you are loved.
I don't think bad is what she was getting at. She was going at arrogantly, arrogant with power.
I understand what you're saying, but the basis though is still there. That he's become this person to be feared. And now she's turning around and saying, Doctor, you are loved.
And although she said this earlier.
It just felt a little weird.
Well, but she's just doing it. She's acknowledging that they have to touch and that he has to die. But before he dies, she's granting him a feel-good moment that says, you're not going to die hated. You're going to your death a loved being, that millions and millions of people love you, and where they can't help you, they are there and they are willing to do it if they could, because you, which I, you know, is very nice, because frankly I don't like the Moffat has been playing this whole. It was a great line in Silence in the Library, Forest of the Dead, where you know the aliens are going to kill him, and he says, look. Give me an hour. You're in the biggest library in the universe, and I'm the Doctor. Look me up. Mm-hmm. And they wait a few seconds, and they go, yep, you got your hour.
Yeah, exactly.
No problem, we're out of here. Nope, it's fine. Because, you know, he's not to be messed with, and that's really the first time we saw that. We saw it in the 11th Hour as well, and in the Pandorica Opens, or the Big Bang. You know, the whole... I am the Doctor, and think before you cross me. I've not been too big of a fan of that. It may very well be the natural extension. I mean, the universe is a very, very, very big place. And unfortunately, we've had far too many instances where the Doctor is saving all of reality. You know, when he would go from planet to planet and save a planet or save a civilization... You know, you could do that forever in an infinite universe.
Yeah, but saving all of reality several times over gets a little stale.
This is going to, you know, put your profile up there. And so it is kind of the natural consequence of what the storytelling has led this to. So they get married. They have a little hand-fasting ceremony using the Doctor's bow tie. And... he tells her, you know, he tells Amy and Rory, he whispers something to her. He says, Amy and Rory, you know, I just told her my name. Don't forget it. Which, of course, we know in Forest of the Dead, she knew his name. And they kiss. Goes back to Lake Silencio. This time she kills him.
Shorted out.
Yep, this time she kills him. They burn the body. and
reality returns to what we
it's supposed
it
to be. And the next scene we see is Amy sitting in the backyard of her house, having a drink with River, who has just climbed out of the Byzantium. They compare their notes. I just climbed out of the Byzantium. Huh, you were so young there.
You didn't have a clue who I was.
Didn't have a clue who I was. And then she says, where were you? And Amy says, well, the doctor is dead. And River reveals the secret. The doctor is not dead. He survived, and Amy and Rory are all happy, and then...
Yeah, it's how he survived that is...
And so then we see him placing... We see a monk putting Dorian back on his pedestal in the headless, or the headful... The head-only archives.
The vault.
The vault.
Or the crypt. The
and
crypt of severed heads.
Dorian recognizes the monk as the doctor, and the doctor reveals it is him, and says, you know... I survived because that was the Tesselecta, and it was a doctor wearing a doctor suit, and I wasn't even singed by the fire. And he's going to pretend to be dead from now on because he just got too big.
And he's going to slip back into the shadows.
Slip back into the shadows and lay low. And Dorian, you know, says, well, then you've still got the fall of the 11th Doctor coming, and the question that must never be answered, the question from the dawn of time.
The question you've been running from all your life.
Doctor Who! Which, oh, I just hate that.
I cringed, but I saw it coming a mile away.
I saw it coming as far back as Silver Nemesis when they basically tried the same thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, and this is time to... point out that Silver Nemesis was back during the beginning of the Andrew Cartmell master plan, where they were trying to make the Doctor more mysterious again.
Mm-hmm.
They felt that he'd gotten too, you know, we knew too much about him, and so they were trying to come up. And I hated it. And I mean,
it was terrible.
It wasn't just that they were horrible stories. I don't like the idea that suddenly, you know, the Doctor isn't just some random Time Lord who escaped.
You've turned him into something...
He's something really important in Time Lord mythology.
Exactly. I mean, the fact that if he has to... That he's been running from this all his life, and that this it can never be answered. It's like he's running from his own past. That he's something much bigger, much greater, much grander than anything we could have possibly imagined. No, I don't like that at all.
And it's not... I mean, it totally conflicts with everything we know. I mean, he wouldn't be a student of Barusa and kind of a piss-poor student.
I mean, I kind of get a laugh out of the fact that he nearly failed Barusa's math classes in the academy. I mean, I think that's great. It shows that the Doctor is somewhat flawed. Brilliant, but flawed. A flawed Time Lord.
But, you know, the fact that we're now putting him up, well, you know, it seemed like during the Cartmell Master Plan, they were putting him up on the level with Rassilon and Omega.
Yeah.
You know, as a top triumvirate of the Time Lords. And now, I think that Moffat has done a better job of trying to set this up. I hope that means that next year the Doctor can just plunk around from planet to planet and not have to worry about... Saving the universe, but the first time he encounters the Daleks, of course, who will know he's not dead? You know,
exactly.
Am I encountering an old you, or I'm encountering a new you? So there's no real reason to lay low. I'd saved it a whole bunch of times before I died, and you hadn't seen it.
If the Silence are also the sentinels of all history, all he's got to do is just raise a finger to help some fledgling little planet, and they're going to know.
I think you're interpreting that wrong. I think Sentinels of History is a derogatory, not from the Silence standpoint, but in other words, they aren't the Sentinels of History.
Yeah, well, I think
they are the self-appointed Sentinels of History. They have decided how they want history to be.
I would agree with that. You know, once the Time Lords kind of went away, then they stepped up and took that mantle upon themselves and are nowhere near qualified to properly hold the position.
They're a religious order, and they have established the way history is supposed to be, and they are... I mean, this is a not-so-subtle jab.
To U.S. history.
Yeah, this is not the not so subtle jab at some of the poorer qualities of organized religion.
Yeah.
About, you know, and so they are, you know, not the sentinels of morals. They are the sentinels of history, the keepers of the way they think it ought to be. And so
keepers of the fantasy.
Yeah, basically. So I think that's probably so they don't know. You know, the reality might run totally in contradiction with them, and they simply don't know for sure what's going on. Of course, the first time the 12th Doctor shows up anywhere...
Oh, boy.
You know, it's like, hey, I think I've spotted the problem here. Mm-hmm. So all that's... It's all very problematic. There's just... Particularly with regards to this fixed point in time. So River is in the suit. She's been...
Adult River's
they trained
the
River... From the time she was a little baby, they brainwashed her to be a psychopath to kill the Doctor. Okay, and fine.
Great.
And then they built a spacesuit that forces her to kill her. Right. What is the point
of why turning into some sort of psychopath?
Why even put somebody in the spacesuit?
Right. If the spacesuit can operate, apparently it can operate on its own. Was the whole point of putting her in there?
The only thing I think that might have something to do with that. Might, and I'm not trying to make an excuse for it. It doesn't. It's not very good. But possibly the fact that she is yet another time-sensitive creature helps make it a fixed point in time. I just had to have these time beings involved in this. In this epic battle, and they're basically forcing her there. But that notwithstanding, if that's the reason it had to be River, was to create the fixed point in time, which is what they're trying to do, basically by creating the fixed point in time, and that the Doctor is the center of the fixed point in time, then I'm thinking the logic is that it's impossible for him to flow around it. Whereas another fixed point in time, if he wasn't directly involved in it, but that as a result of that fixed point in time, you might expect him to be killed, time might be circumvented around that, and the Doctor would continue to live. But by making his death the fixed point in time, then there's no way around it. And that's probably their reason they're trying to engineer it the way they are. And boy, am I really giving him more credit than is deserved for that. So they got, all they have to do is to get River in the suit, get the suit there to do that. Then why waste all the effort to make her a psychopath so that she'll kill it on her own? Because she nearly killed him at Let's Kill Hitler.
Exactly.
Which would have fouled up their entire plan.
That would have messed everything
up
anyway, because he would have died before before his fixed point. I mean, even the
Tesselecta,
they had it on files. He's supposed to die this particular day. He's not supposed to die any sooner. And yet there he was. So what was the whole point? I don't know.
Doesn't make
any sense to me.
Doesn't make any sense, no. It's really, really weird. So I'm thinking that now if you take a look at River's timeline and you look at it in the order that we saw her, so she's born on Demon's Run, she's kidnapped, she's taken to Earth in the 60s, she's raised as a child, she's built the spacesuit, as Silence, she escapes at the same time Amy shoots her, basically. She escapes from the suit. She goes out onto the streets of New York. I think it was New York. Somewhere. Streets of some city. And she regenerates. And then the next time we see her as a young child, she's in Leadworth, which is 20 years later.
Later, yeah.
All right, we'll ignore that little minor continuity. Problem. She's raised and she gets in the TARDIS. She shoots the TARDIS. She nearly she regenerates into River. She nearly kills the Doctor, but instead she gives up all her regenerations to him. Then we see her. She gets her degree. Then she goes off and refuses to help at the Battle of Demon Run because she would cross her own timeline. And then she Let's see. Well, then
they, is this
well,
what
then
you were seeing in The Confidential?
Sorry, yes, more or less. Then wait, before she does that, she kills him.
Right, because it's right after she gets her degree.
Right, but she
that
kills him.
She's then taken by Madame Kavorian and the alien Silence to fulfill her destiny.
Fulfilled. So she's killed the doctor, Fink, and now here's the thing. So then we go on to the Pandorica and the Big Bang.
Yeah.
Now think about this.
I can't wait
We've been making a mistake all along, actually. It's a natural mistake because, of course, we watch Doctor Who. Doctor Who is a show, and we follow Doctor Who from the beginning to end. So, therefore, it's logical that the Doctor is running in the correct order. But in fact, the Doctor is the one traveling around in time. The Doctor is not running in the correct order. River is running in correct time because she's aging and passing through time relatively. You know, the only time she travels in time, she has to steal a time bracelet.
Mm-hmm.
So she's the one. So her timeline is actually the correct timeline with her and the Silence and all that stuff. And so, after she's killed the Doctor, which is a fake, but the Silence believe the Doctor is dead, she then goes to the Pandorica and the Big Bang, and the Silence try to blow up the TARDIS. Why? That's happened after they think the Doctor is dead. They would now be trying to kill the Doctor and the universe prior, his prior, to the fixed point in time, which they've already accomplished, they think.
The Doctor was, they're attempting to kill the Doctor on April 22nd.
And they think they've achieved that.
And they think they've achieved it.
And it's a fixed point in time. Everybody knows it is. It's all in all the books,
right?
Apparently.
So,
how do you know that?
When was the Pandorica and the bit with the TARDIS?
After it in River's timeline. After it in the Silence's timeline. Because she's already in jail. She's done it. The Doctor is dead.
We don't know when she got sentenced, though.
After she killed him.
But we don't know when, what year that was.
Doesn't matter, does it?
Yes, it does.
Why?
Because it could still happen, calendar-wise, it could still take place. She could still be sentenced, or she could be sentenced long after. And because she does time travel too, I mean, my question is,
but the whole she's, why would they try to kill him? They've already, but she, her timeline, not where she is in timeline. Her personal timeline is the one that runs parallel with the Silence. Why are they trying to... Why is the Silence will fall nonsense still going on for her? You know, why isn't it showing up in Silence in the Library?
Well, I agree. That doesn't make any sense.
It just doesn't quite... And, of course, it still doesn't make any sense as to why and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They want to do it in the first place, but
even if you were – I mean, no matter how you look at it, it doesn't make any sense. If they've already – yeah, you're right. If they've already got it figured out that the Doctor's death is this particular fixed point in time, yeah, then what's to be served by
– All you could do is trying to circumvent the fixed point in time.
Well
– which would be bad.
I mean –
I think.
Did they think that by locking the Doctor in the Pandorica that was also going to, you know, prevent the fall of the 11th? I don't know. The whole thing just – yeah, it doesn't exactly stack up very well.
No. I don't know what to make of that, but it just seems like there's an awful lot of the Silence trying to hurt the Doctor or kill the Doctor when wouldn't that be contrary to what they're trying to do, which is to create the fixed point in time where he does die?
Here's something. Yeah, okay. Well, go on.
No, that's it. Go ahead.
Well, I'm going to jump back to Lake Silencio. Something that I'm kind of having some issues with. Okay, let's now see if we can get this right. Now, we learn.
Which way are we coming at it? Doctor's space or River's path.
It doesn't matter.
Okay.
We learn that the Doctor was inside the Tesselecta.
Yes.
He never really died.
Right.
Okay. So does that mean that when we see River discharge her weapon elsewhere, that that was still the Doctor inside the Tesselecta? I'm inclined to think so.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Where does the schism take place then?
Well, this is all
bad. Because the Doctor didn't really die. The Doctor never really died. So you're not really changing the fixed point in time.
Well, okay. So they're trying to engineer a fixed point. Now, I'm clawing for it here. They're trying to engineer a fixed point in time. And so we have two possibilities. One is the first go-round, she did shoot him and he did die. And the second time through, she didn't shoot him and that caused the split. And the second time through, he was the Tesselecta.
I don't believe that.
I don't buy that. I think that he had to be the Tesselecta both times.
Exactly. He has
they were
be.
Trying to engineer a fixed point in time, and they did engineer a fixed point in time, but it's not the fixed point in time they thought they were engineering. They thought they were engineering the Doctor's death, but in fact, they were engineering the Tesselecta getting shot.
Okay. Now here we go.
So they've been fooled. They've done shoddy workmanship. They created the fixed point, but it's not what they think they got.
Okay, now let's define fixed point in time.
It's whatever the writer wants it to be.
Oh, that's what it is. Okay, see, because I was kind of looking at it from a more technical scientific.
Oh well, yes.
That a fixed point in time will be something that revolves around temporal mechanics. And if that were the case, then River discharging her weapon becomes no different than the Doctor masquerading his death. It's exactly the same thing. Because you can't trick.
You can't trick time.
Verse.
Well, that's and the yeah.
But that's what they've said that he's done
here. That's kind of what it seemed like he's done. That's why I was trying to put the thing on it. So they didn't trick time. They just nobody quite understood what time really fixed
so
down.
And what bothers me, I think, is a lot of people are going to watch this and say, oh, yes, he satisfied it. He fooled the silence.
No.
And says, no, you can't fool time.
Yeah. Well, you can because obviously it stops clocks for no apparent reason.
Which it should have never happened in the
By
first
By the way, here's another problem with this plan. So, who was at the beach there with the Doctor? Amy and Rory, right?
It was Amy, Rory.
And where was Amy and Rory from?
They were from... Well, 2002...
Right after their Christmas special.
So yeah, this is right after the Christmas special, yes.
Okay. So, that's who got tossed into the screwed-up timeline. Therefore, Amy wouldn't know anything about pirates, which were drawn up on her.
That is true. I caught that also. I saw that and thought, wait a minute, she shouldn't know anything about that.
And when they did kick over into the other universe, presumably that's the Doctor's Tesselecta that's kicked over into the other universe. So the soothsayer is actually the Tesselecta? Right? Or is it?
It would seem so.
And so did the crew of the Tesselecta remember the universe? Or not? Or or are they mystified and somewhere out there flying along in a car with a balloon on it?
Don't know.
And how did the Tesselecta start regenerating? Which it did.
Yeah, the regeneration energy. That's the other problem.
I suppose the Doctor could have programmed that. He's clever
it's
that
possible,
way.
It's possible. And I looked at it when I watched it tonight. I thought, okay, well maybe
when they showed it
programmed, with its shape shifting abilities, maybe he just simply created the illusion that it was regenerative energy that we were seeing.
Maybe.
Just to further throw off, it's a huge stretch, but that's the best I can come up with.
Yeah.
And then we also have to come back to this whole thing. Rule one.
Moffat lies.
Moffat lies is really what it comes to. That is rule one. Moffat lies. Because we were lied to about There is a death. It is a death. No, it wasn't. It was never a death.
No, it doesn't appear to have been.
I mean, last week we were saying it was a death when it happened in the episode, but it's going to be undone. Guess what? It was never done in the first place.
I think that's right. I think that's correct. It was never done in the first place. I think.
I agree. I mean, if we're gonna look at causality the way that it is, and here's the thing. It has to be the Tesselecta in order for the timelines to even slightly tie up correctly. You have to make it the Tesselecta. It's the only way for this whole thing to work. Otherwise, you start getting into these – you get even more multiple timelines going on, and then you can't keep the story straight whatsoever. So,
well, I think we've demonstrated that they can't keep the story straight.
Well, they can't keep the story straight.
I don't.
But by having it be the Tesselecta, always be the Tesselecta, that's the only way that this thing could make some kind of sense at the end of the day.
Like I said, I kind of enjoy the episode.
It was an amusing ride.
But there was one part of it that I really did not like. And I really felt this was the biggest cheat in the episode, and it's a small thing, but it really doesn't come. It's really not. It just doesn't really ring true, and it's been the problem all along. At the end, River is talking about how hard it is for her to pretend not to know Amy, and how hard it was for her to pretend not to know
to recognize the space suit in Florida.
And stuff like that. And I'm sorry. It doesn't jive. There's just not the slightest hint in any of that performance, anywhere along the way, in anything that River ever says or ever does, that could give you the slightest clue that she had foreknowledge at all. I mean,
I'm glad you brought that up.
I mean, for crying out loud, when the first time she meets, well, of course that wouldn't apply because she's grown up with Amy and Rory, so I suppose that's all right. But I was going to say, the first time she meets Donna, she's like, this is Donna? Oops. Oh. She didn't make a fool of herself. So, I mean, she's not exactly, somebody who is so tight on her emotions that she can't make a hideous faux pas when she encounters somebody.
Okay, let me jump back a couple of episodes to The Girl Who Waited, which, by the way, I was right.
I will go along with you to say that they did not go anywhere with anything in any of that or any of the previous episodes that there's been stuff in that looks like it has some meaning.
They were either red herrings or they were just – it was just botched writing.
Well, you know, there is the question there as to whether or not it's a red herring or botched writing. And I can live with a red herring. I mean, obviously the flesh was a red herring. The line about, oh, well, who knows, maybe you could reconstitute, the Liz on the Matrix was really kind of – that one really felt like an obvious red herring. But – you know, there's been a lot of stuff. And I wouldn't put it past Moffat to throw out red herrings.
No.
However, I'm still going to say, because I watched that episode again, I'm still going to say there's supposed to be something there. I don't know what it is, though. Maybe something was cut out of the episode that we should have seen.
I don't think so.
It's just not.
I think it was just shoddy craftsmanship.
For somebody who nailed the character of Amy so well. Her shallowness and everything. It just, there's something there that I'm just not catching, and it has nothing to do with the story arc, nothing to do with the story arc. I concede that completely.
Well, anyway, the reason I brought it up, when we were talking about,
because you don't
get
to say you're right very often.
Well, that's part of it. I'll get back to that also, the fact that I was right on this. I will get back to that. David made a point on saying that when younger Amy made this big technobabble little blurb, that she made this face. And I'm thinking, okay, that's the face that River should have made when she saw the spacesuit. It could be just for a flash.
She's got lines like, She tore her way out of the suit. Whatever she is, she must be incredibly strong.
That line felt like, and you, Simon, and I all thought the same thing, that this was somebody who really had no idea what the heck was going on.
Yes.
And of course, we had this big problem with, well, the only way this could work is if she doesn't remember. Well, BS. She remembers.
And yet the doctor says, the doctor says to her when she's shooting him, you first he says, you won't even remember this. Then he says, you probably don't even remember.
It turns out she does.
So apparently, yeah. Well, but we do have a good argument that says there's a lot of stuff she shouldn't remember because she didn't recognize Madame Kavorian or the Silence. Of course, the Silence. Well, you don't remember the Silence.
No.
So, I mean, they did blank some of her memory, so it's possible she doesn't remember being a child in the spacesuit, but not at the point in time where she is now.
Right.
Because she'd know that the spacesuit is the spacesuit that she killed the doctor in. Because she'd already witnessed there's something.
And it was kind of hinted when the doctor is talking to younger River, why would you bring me here? So that you could see this.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that whole thing kind of seemed a little strange. But there was a little bit of a funny payoff when in that final scene with River, Amy, and Rory, where River makes the proclamation because, you know, I'm the doctor's wife. Well, first I have to ask, okay, River, just
really?
A little while ago, you just, when you were talking to Amy, you called it an altered, aborted timeline.
Right.
So are you really married?
Right. Good question.
So let's just go with the fact that she is. I'm his wife. And then, of course, the funniest part, and for me this was actually the best part of the episode, is when Amy gets to say, and I'm his mother-in-law.
Yeah.
And the look on her face, I have to admit, that was the shining moment in the entire episode.
Because she knows she tried to jump his bones.
Exactly. But now I do want to go back on one other thing. Okay, yes, I do get to make the proclamation. Yes, I was right about that. However, you too were right. You made two predictions.
Only two?
You made two that I remembered that paid off in this episode.
That's how cold reading works. All right, go ahead.
The first one is you predicted the eye patch.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I just listened to earlier today. I just listened to our previous podcast, and you made the prediction on the eye patch, and I said, "Oh yeah, you're spot on." And I think several weeks ago, you made the prediction that it was the Tesselecta.
Yeah,
that was on Lex Lansing. Well, yeah, Eugene got that one right too. So, as far as those two goes, you nailed them.
I'll take it because I did say that, but I think in all fairness. I don't know if you saw when I was tweeting. I know you were trying not to see it, tweeting during the episode.
I was coming back from California.
I did make a tweet right after the episode that said, if you throw enough shite against the wall, some of it will stick.
Some of it will stick, yeah.
And I subsequently got interpretations from people that they thought I was talking about Moffat's writing, that he was flinging it around, but in fact I was actually kind of referring to me making enough predictions that some of them finally had to be right.
Ah.
But it was a little bit of both, but it was actually
I thought you were talking about Moffat too.
Yeah, I was kind of purposely ambiguous about that, but that actually was what the comment was. Because if I was like, oh, it's the Tesselect, because I remember it's like, oh, it's got to be the flesh, and then the Tesselect goes like, oh, no, it's got to be the Tesselect. If he'd introduced them in the opposite order, I probably would be on the, you know, oh no, it's the flesh at the end, but I'm not going to say. But yeah, I mean, at least that was foreshadowed in such a way that you could, although nobody else in the Silence Army in Good Man Goes to War was wearing the eye patch. So, you know, we just thought Madame Kavorian was, so I don't even know if that wasn't a retcon.
Well, as far as they goes, I kind of think that they were being played for fools and had no idea what was really going on.
That's quite quite possible. So, okay, so I do have a couple other things. One I thought was kind of interesting was when so Captain Williams is working for Amelia Pond, and he doesn't remember her, and she remembers that she's looking for Rory, but she doesn't know that it's him because she's deeply in love with him, and
she thinks,
and I can accept that. I mean, she's got her memories and stuff, and she has to write them down, and so she's got this guy in her head that she loves deeply, and but she can't pull it forth any more than she can a sketch, which looks a bit more like James Dean.
Yeah, it didn't quite look like Arthur Darvill.
And so he's there. He doesn't remember anything, and he doesn't remember anything, and this is the key part. And he's sacrificing his life to save her. And the doctor, he's standing against the silence. He's got the eye patch on, which is now working against him and causing him agonizing pain. And he's trying to hold off the last line of defense. And he falls to the ground in agony. And the silence talk to him, and they say,
"Rory Williams.
Rory Williams, the man who died
and died again,
died and died, died many times, die one last time, and know that she will never come back for you."
Right.
And then she comes back for him and kills him. How do they know that?
I was wondering, how the hell did they know that?
And why is that important enough for them to even mention?
The only thing that I can think of is, again, whatever it is about them, somehow they're able to perceive time in such sort of a screwy way that allows them to remember what reality was really supposed to be all about.
But why bother taunting him with it when he doesn't remember it, you know? It's like, well, yeah, okay. It just was an odd thing. And know that she won't come back, will never come back for you. Why? Why that taunt? I didn't quite get it.
Yeah, it does make sense because he doesn't understand what they're talking about.
Then she does come back and guns him down with a machine gun.
She does figure it out.
And she remembers who he is, too. So she says, "We'll get a drink, we'll get married." And he's like, "Okay, I'm good." And the other thing is, obviously they can change this on a drop of a hat. I kind of get the impression that River is never supposed to see the doctor again, or more importantly, that the doctor is never to see River again, that he's not going to go back to her. All the time that she has with the doctor is going the other way.
Based on the one line when she and Amy are talking, you can always see the doctor. You'll be seeing the younger version of the doctor. And that's true because from a ongoing standpoint, if we're looking forward in River's timeline, and if everything Moffat has said is correct, that they're meeting in opposite directions,
roughly opposite
temporally.
He does actually say roughly opposite in the Doctor Who Confidential.
Well, thank God for that. That means that you can kind of break. Well, and obviously they have to be. Mm-hmm. But yes, for the most part, they are meeting in opposite directions. Then yes, she generally would be meeting younger versions of him from this point on, and maybe she's very close to the David Tennant doctor. Maybe she might be just a couple of steps away from.
She's at the Byzantium.
She's at the Byzantium right now,
which is after the Pandorica, which is after. So she's had all of the adventures with him that occurred between the arrival at the car and the arrival at the diner. Right, the doctor's 200-year gap. She's already had all those with him, so
she does.
She's
have
pretty much out of
she,
them, yeah.
But we know that she's got. Well, not counting Silence of the Library, she has at least one more.
Where is that?
Well, although maybe we've already had
no,
it.
No, we've already had
we may,
it.
We may have already had it. That's right. That might have been during the gap, because she tells David Tennant's doctor about the last time she saw him,
mm-hmm.
and how he looked so incredibly sad
mm-hmm.
when he said goodbye. He took her somewhere, you know, blue crystals, blah, 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 who knows where it was.
That could be. Now, to be fair, that might be That might be the one and only time, you know, he might make an exception and go see her in his forward timeline. I don't know, but
that's the one that I'm hooking on. And she says that when he left her, he seemed incredibly sad, and she didn't know why.
Mm-hmm.
And then she figures it out because she realized that this was it. She's now about to give her life to save the doctor.
Of course, you know, that whole backwards forward thing kind of conflicts with a whole, like, you know, there's got to be a first time, last time we ever kissed.
Oh yeah.
And so that would have occurred after her last time. And it doesn't really sound like that. It sounds more romantic when he came to see her with his new suit and everything. But I think that one is just kind of out of canon. They needed to get her a sonic screwdriver, and they hadn't come up with this idea. But yes, I think generally speaking, we're done with River. I think she's done.
I think so too.
I think they've said, you know, Alex Kingston, you're great. Thank you. We love your work. We love that you're doing. You're a big name star. We're so happy you were actually willing to come down here and do 6 episodes of Doctor Who, but we can't rely on you being available to write stories.
Well, and if
and so, you know, I think I've ended the River line. I think this is
Moffat
done.
Is really trying to, because this is in a sense sort of a reset, not so much of the series, not like. Like what maybe Russell T. Davies had tried to do when he killed all the Time Lords. This is more like just a reset for the Doctor's character, a redirection,
mm-hmm.
a redirecting of the Doctor's character by his own admission. Time to slip back into the shadows. That would kind of suggest to me that okay, he doesn't plan to really hang around River all that much anymore. It's just
well, that would be dangerous if he's trying to hide.
Even if you're going to stay within the continuity of the series, it would be dangerous to do so. So he knows he's got to go off and he's got to do his own thing, find new companions, and just lay low for a while.
I'm guessing that his idea of laying low is much the same way when he was running from the Time Lord. So we're talking pre-Troughton, or pre-Pertwee. Laying low is, I'm just bounding around, and I'm, you know, then he was laying low from the Time Lords, now he's laying low from the silence. Of course, you know, he arrives on Earth and the Silence are everywhere because they've always been there. But that's
yeah.
another story.
So he can't go back to Earth.
Yep, never again. Can't go back to Earth. So I'm guessing that's the idea, and he does his stuff. Although here's my question. So in Pyramids of Mars, okay, the Doctor is there in 1913 or whatever it was.
Right.
And Sutekh is coming out of the thing, and Sutekh is going to destroy everything in the universe. And the Sarah Jane says, you know, oh, well, why don't we just go to 1980 and leave? And the Doctor says, well, I can't because, you know, Sutekh will destroy everything. But it didn't happen. And the Doctor takes her to 1984 or 5 or whatever year it is, and the Earth is a desolate, destroyed wasteland. All right? Remember that
mm-hmm.
sequence?
Yeah. Yes, I do.
Wouldn't that have contravened the fixed point in time?
I was thinking that very thought.
I mean, obviously he can't destroy the Earth, because if he did, then Lake Silencio is not going to be there, and they couldn't have their fixed point. It's like...
Yeah.
The fixed point in time is just a bad,
it's
bad,
a bad
idea.
Plot device, and I'm very sorry that RTD brought it up. Because he made more problems by introducing, but he just doesn't seem to care. I mean, he's supposed to be a Doctor Who fanboy, yet he writes these things and has them put into the stories that do more harm than good.
I'm not even going to blame that one on Russell T. Davies. I mean, we do have problems with Doctor Who, in that you can go back into the Hartnell era, and you know you can't rewrite the Aztecs. There is nothing you can do to change this situation, and we see that in stories, that time is fixed and they can't change it. And yet in other stories, obviously they are doing something that is changing time. So we've never had a consistent
system. Well, that's even correct. At the very end of Seeds of Doom, The doctor has got Sarah, and he says, "I can take you back to even before we to a point even before we left." And
I thought
Sarah
you couldn't
said,
do that.
"I thought you couldn't do it." And Tom Baker's doctor says, "Oh, of course I can do that." So it's like, okay, I guess the rules change with every regeneration.
Yeah. So I mean, I think that in Waters of Mars, when they try introduce the fixed point in time, I think that's when we first got introduced.
Actually, no, we got it before then. We got it with
Vesuvius.
Yes.
Vesuvius is a fixed point in time. We can't
Precisely.
Change it.
We can't save those people. They are supposed to die.
And I think that basically Russell was trying to devise a mechanism that allows you to either say, here's time can't be rewritten, and there's time can be rewritten, and from a scriptwriter's point of view, we can do it both ways now. And I don't disagree with that. I mean, good. They're trying to rectify a real problem with the chronology of Doctor Who. But you don't take. But that's still problematic. You don't take that and then try to write a story around it.
Especially if
because
you apply
it's
that
a
to
bad
the
foundation.
Life.
It's a good little side. It's like timey-wimey. You know, as long as all you ever do is you walk through the room and say, how come I can't change that? And you go, it's a fixed point in time. As long as you just kind of push it off to the side real quick, like, you know, it's like Superman's immune to bullets, then you're fine. But when you actually take that notion of the fixed point in time and you really turn it into a plot point, you're getting into that problematic territory. And you know, we had that in Waters of Mars. I think that was the problematic point in that story, which they resolved by having time supposedly fix itself, but it really didn't. And then in this one, so this is Moffat's fault. Pure, plain, and simple to take the notion of using a fixed point in time and really, really trying to exploit it as a story point, and it just doesn't work. And, you know, far worse than what Davies did. And Russell T. Davies, if indeed it was even his idea or the writer, was at least trying to reconcile a real problem that they had. That, you know, now I can play it both ways and not violate continuity as long as we don't scrutinize it too closely, which is, you know, why you had to fix it anyways, because people would scrutinize things too closely, like some people I could mention on this podcast at the moment.
Yes.
That'd be us, you and I. I think we're scrutinizing.
That's what we do.
Oh, yeah. That's,
and it's because we love the show.
I know it does seem like we just did bitch, but I mean, it's
born out of love. We love the show. I mean, it's we get excited when the series comes back on. I mean, I was very excited about when it was coming back on for this year. And unfortunately,
because I thought we got all this BS out of the way last year with the Pandoric.
You know, one of the things that we need to think about is, of course, there's something very interesting about how Matt Smith's doctor said that he needs to slip back into the shadows. He's been too visible, so he's going to kind of lay low a little bit. Well, oddly enough, so is the series, because we are getting next year, after the Christmas special, we are getting an abbreviated season.
Is it an abbreviated season, or are they just skipping it over into the next year?
That's what I've been hearing, that it's going to be a short... Well, that's a good question now. Now I'm not quite sure. I've heard that it was... First, one story said that it was going to be just... we weren't going to get any Doctor Who.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was another story that says we were going to get Doctor Who, but we weren't going to get a full season.
Okay, so what if they did this? Let's say they went April. This year they went April and September for two split things. So what if they went to, July and January or something? So they, I mean, we have to take into account a couple of things. One, Patrick Troughton was an evil, evil man. Sorry, Patrick Troughton fans, but he's the guy that ran around and kept telling everyone, whoever got the job of the doctor, you know, just do it for three
just
years.
Just 3 years only.
So you can avoid being typecast. And so we have that. And that seems to be keeping the Doctors chopping and changing pretty quickly since then. And I don't,
which I've never liked.
I don't like that. I think that's too short. I realize that this show is a brutal, brutal shoot for these actors. But, you know, my concern here is that Matt Smith is probably planning on 3 years. And they've got one more year. There's a real possibility that Moffat might leave after his third year as well, if he's going to go out with his Doctor. You know, I've done what I want with a show. So I think what we've had set up here, the fall of the 11th, you know, is a foreshadowing of his regeneration. And we know that if you skip next year, 2012, and you go into 2013 instead to finish your Doctor Who...
We're into the 50th anniversary.
You're in the 50th anniversary, and I think that anybody coming up close who worked on the show would want to stick around...
Matt Smith has already gone on record. I think Moffat has too.
And this may be how they do it.
They will be involved with the 50th anniversary.
And by skipping a year or abbreviating the year.
Abbreviating it is what they're going
to
do.
But the
year of the 50th, from what I remember reading, and maybe somebody has something that's a bit clearer, more up to date, whatever. But what little I do seem to remember reading is that 2013 was going to be a full season.
They did say they were going to have a full season. Originally, they did definitely commit to another full season with Matt Smith. So, but that might not be till 2013. That was kind of the way they phrased it. So I don't know. I don't know what the situation is, but it is something to consider that it may be quite some time off.
But there is supposed to be some kind of a commitment, because apparently there's a commitment with the BBC to produce some Doctor Who episodes for 2012.
We can have some of those delightful movies like we had in that
gap year. Oh, please not.
And then one thing we didn't mention, we should have mentioned this, was probably a touching but necessary moment in the episode was when the Doctor was on his farewell, well, actually, when he was now past his farewell tour and was on his I'm going to find out as much as I can about the Silence, he still steadfastly denying that he has to die, and he decides to go out for a night on the town with his old friend Brigadier Lethbridge Stewart, and that's when he learns that Brigadier has died. And
that seems to
galvanize him
trigger,
and saying,
yeah,
yep, it,
yeah, he then pulls the invitations out of his pocket and says, okay, it's time to go.
So, Nicholas Courtney, the actor who played the Brigadier, died a few months ago, and it's a shame that they never actually got him into New Who, even if in just some sort of a small part, but... it was nice that they gave him a name check, basically.
Yeah, I mean, it's
and that it deeply affected the Doctor. That's more important than just saying, "Hey, he's dead."
I just think it's tragic that the Briggs' last appearance in a Doctor Who episode was a Sylvester McCoy.
I think that would be true of anybody who was in one of those episodes.
At least he got to someone redeem it and appear in an episode of Sarah Jane.
Yeah. So, and of course, he couldn't name check the dead Sarah Jane because that show is still on.
Yes,
for a while. So they really couldn't use her as the.
The night that we were recording this was the premiere of the final season.
But you know, one thing about the name check for the Brigadier, I thought they were a little bit mean. Too, because he calls up the nursing home and he says, you know, get him, tell him to get dressed, we're going out for a night on the town and it's all on me. And the nurse says, oh, doctor, we you know, the Brigadier passed away, but if it's any comfort, he talked about
talked
you a
about
lot
you
and he always had us put out an extra glass of brandy for you in case
harsh.
You'd show up. That was kind of harsh. I can't imagine a nurse saying that. I mean, that is so mean.
Talk about projecting guilt.
Yeah. Yeah, that was, I mean, I know it wasn't meant to be mean.
But it's survivor's
like, wow.
Guilt now.
Yeah, that was, you know, it's like I should have stopped by when I had the time, but I don't. And of course, you do have the time, you have the time machine, but that'd be crossing the streams. But
he hasn't done that already. I mean, you look back.
He wouldn't deliver the invitations himself because that would cross his time stream. But then he brings River to the point where she's crossing her own.
Exactly.
It doesn't make any sense.
So the whole
we're back to that again.
I can't cross my own time streams now.
Okay. Well, there's no more Doctor Who until
December.
I suppose there's just the slightest possibility that we might arrange for some sort of a Doctor Who season wrap-up episode, but it won't be right away. And so we will be back to our typical fare of good and bad classic science fiction.
Oh, dear God.
There's still that Man from Atlantis and some more Star Lost and UFO and Doomwatch, and we have got some other stuff that we are just itching to share with you.
Mm-hmm.
And so we hope you'll join us again next time on Fusion Patrol.
Cheers.
You've been listening to the Fusion Patrol podcast, a production of Lone Locust Productions. Join us on our new discussion forums at FusionPatrol.com. Find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, username Fusion Patrol. You can also send us feedback by email at feedback@FusionPatrol.com. If you'd like to support Fusion Patrol, please leave us a review on iTunes. Fusion Patrol's theme music is Fight the Future by Amberwolf.